Well, thank you, ladies. That was lovely. Very lovely. I married a flautist. Lady that plays a flute. Anyway, very nice job indeed. So thank you. Welcome again to everyone. Happy Sabbath to all of you that are here and to the Zoomers out there somewhere. So welcome. Always remember, Mr. Fish, I'm sure, would have mentioned it. After services, please join us for what we call here fellowship and Karakatoa. No, make that koinonia, sorry. Mr. Madison and I did not collude on our messages, but I think you're going to find some similarities in how we begin them and how we end them. I did a little bit of a rewrite, but it's interesting. But we did not share notes. We've been keeping our study in Acts with the thought that we are, as the first century believers are, going through a type of Babylon, type of very, very strange world. It's interesting the comments people make about this series. They've read the book of Acts many, many times. But indeed, one of the things that the book of Acts teaches us is this motivation that they have, why they do the things they do. And in fact, in general, as it relates to the society and culture around us, you have to wonder sometimes what makes people do the things they do. What motivates them? Living in the 21st century Babylon, especially here in Southern California, is unique and interesting. Would you agree with me? How many of you got a phone call or a text or an email? Are you flooded out there, right? Did anybody? I got four or five. I said, I don't live in the hills of Hollywood nor in Los Angeles. But the news that out of Southern California, in fact, California, goes nationwide, and everyone seems to know or think they know what we do here. It's interesting. But there's also the crazy side of Babylon, isn't there? Let me give you a few examples. In reviewing the instructions for a newer iron that we have for clothes, it said, warning in bold, do not use iron on clothes being worn. I won't ask how many of you have done that. Yeah, that's good advice. Taking a hot iron on your clothes while you're still wearing them, not a good idea. Warning on our blender, do not open cover while blender is in operation, keeping face and hands away from blades. Very good advice. I recently picked up a can of paint thinner. I was doing some painting, and it said on the side, do not ingest. If ingestion, seek immediate medical assistance and treatment. Who are these people? Who would drink paint thinner? I mean, the first few gulps would tell you it ain't vodka. Who are these people? In fact, I need to humbly tell you, I be one of those people. I can relate to that last warning, kind of. I have drunk paint thinner. I know. Like Mr. Stan, I'm going to go back. I'm only going to go back 35 years when I was about two or three. When I was two or three, they were doing some painting around the house, and I picked up a glass fruit jar that had paint thinner in it, and I drank it. I wound up in the ER. Had my stomach pumped. How many of you have had your stomach pumped? Come on. How many of you wished you had your stomach pumped? Yeah. I had my stomach pumped, and there's been very few side effects from drinking that paint thinner. My mother was furious. Furious. She referenced it till I think I was in my 30s. But we live in a strange world. The things that politicians do, that governments do, what were you thinking? Did you think this through? Every day, it seems there's something new. In criminal law, motivation is important. Motive is key. I checked. I watched Perry Mason, but I Googled it. Now, I didn't ask the two lawyers that we have here with us because they're not criminal lawyers. You're not a criminal lawyer, are you? No? You're confused? Some of the people you felt were criminals? They're not criminal lawyers, but motive is everything. What was their motive? What drove this person to do this thing? And people have understandable motives that we may disagree with them. We still maybe understand what their motivation to do this certain activity was. How many of you have had Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons come to your door? Wow. I want to see, one more time, look at the hands. Okay, how many of you have not had? Would be the better question. You have it? Yeah, right. You weren't home when they were there. I bring it up for a reason. Most of us have. There's always two. Rarely, if ever, I've never seen one, but they always come in twos, and they feel they have a biblical motive. Now, we may not agree with that, but I heard a story recently. Two Jehovah's Witnesses knocked on my door yesterday, said a guy. So I answered it and asked them if they wanted to come in. They said, yeah, sure. I said to them, I'm making some tea. Would you like some? They said, yeah, sure. So they came in. We sat down on the couch, and I looked at them and said, okay, so what now? They looked at each other and said, we really don't know. We've never gotten this far before. Now you laugh. You laugh. You laugh. And say what you will. But down deep inside, you have to admire their tenacity, their commitment, their motivation. You must agree. Acts 18 presents such a study in application and motivation. So today, as we approach another unique set of actions in this chapter, like the last chapter, 17, it's got some classic lines in it, some controversial lines in it, but as we go through this, we will look at a unique set of actions by people that we honor, we respect, and we think we know. So the title is Acts 18, By All Means, I Must Keep This Feast. So let's begin chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, Paul departed from Athens. If you remember Acts chapter 17 in Athens and the Areopagus and the Stoa, he leaves Athens and he goes to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew there named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius in Rome had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. It's a separate story, very interesting, don't have time for it. So there where Paul is, and he runs into them and he came to them. So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked. Notice that. So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, Aquila and Priscilla, and worked. In other words, he applied the trade for which he had been trained. Most rabbis at the time, they were teaching rabbis. He was a Pharisee, as we know. They had a full-time job or had a full-time trade that they fell back on, and that's what they paid their expenses with. What's interesting, how many of you have been to Corinth? A lot of you. It's about an hour drive. On foot, it's about 18 hours. I'm not sure how Paul got there. But if you go to the Corinth site for the Greek government, they give chapter 18 as part of their Greek government information on the site for Corinth. Corinth, we have two books from the church that was established at Corinth, and some scholars believe there was up to six different letters because in those two, 1 and 2 Corinthians, there are allusions to other letters, so we really don't know. Corinth was a large church, a number of churches. Chuck Swindoll says that these epistles, 1 and 2 Corinthians, should be renamed. You know what he thinks they should be renamed? 1 and 2 Californians. Corinth was such a diverse place, such a hub of center and trade, and as we know, California, and I'm a proud Californian, it's the eighth largest economy in the world. But it's very eclectic here. Corinth was a diverse place and a challenging place. So is where we live, where we exist. Corinth, like here, had two football teams and both made it to the Super Bowl in the last few years. Just joking. Verse 2, he meets Aquila and Priscilla, again, their fellow tent makers. Notice in verse 4, and he reasoned in the synagogues every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. As we read through the book of Acts, chapter 18, notice the different people and their names. Jews, Greeks, Romans, whoever they may be, it's critically important to understand who's being addressed and who does what. And so every Sabbath, Paul goes to the synagogue and persuades both Jews and Greeks. Every Sabbath, as is custom, he reasoned with them. The word reason there, when he says or persuaded, depending on the translation that you have, it's an interesting word. It means dialegomai. It means to dialogue. It's where we get the word dialectic as well as dialogue. It means to have a discussion. And it's important to understand this was the time and setting for this activity. They came, thankfully we don't, they came to the synagogue in many cases to dialogue, to talk to each other, to understand one another, to discuss. They often had friendly and civil debates. But again, this was accepted at the time. So when Paul goes there, he observes the Sabbath. He understands what happens because of his background and his training. In verse 5, it says, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, northern Greece, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. But when they opposed him and blasphemed, he shook his garments and said to them, your blood, I mean, just picture this, your blood be upon your heads. I am clean. For now, here's that famous phrase, for now on I will go to the Gentiles. Just picture him shaking his cloak, right? I've had it. I've had enough. We'll see just how long Paul holds that thought. That I'm no longer going to the Jews, I'm going to the Gentiles. And he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God and whose house was next door to the synagogue. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Let me ask you a question. How can we apply these verses, which are important? How do we apply these verses to where we live, how we live, and who we are? How do we apply them? In the city that we live, our family lives, there is a synagogue, there is a Buddhist temple, and we even, have a new Mormon temple going up. Yeah, serious. It's going to be something. Might I walk into any one of these establishments proclaiming to the Jews at the synagogue that Jesus is the Messiah, and they've missed it? Could I do that? I could. Could I go into the Buddhist temple and the new Mormon church when it's constructed? Can I go in there and explain to them that the Sabbath and holy days are to be observed? Again, that Jesus is the Christ? Yes, I could. Well, I would also have a 90% chance of being arrested, kind of like putting my face in a blender or drinking paint thinner. The objective would not be met, and the result would be very, very similar. I can't do those things. The same outcome. Further, would we appreciate someone coming into our congregation after services? No, we would not appreciate it, and we don't appreciate it. It's rude, it's obnoxious, and it's not the setting. But will we do for the truth what others do for what we would say, not so much the truth? Would we do the same? It's interesting, because we can't do what Paul did. But when we continue with Acts, after Paul's famous pronouncement of who he would preach to, let's continue. Now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack or hurt you. I have many people in this city. And he continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. Who's them? The Corinthians. Who are the Corinthians? Jews, Gentiles. Believers, non-believers. Do we really believe that Paul would not have attended synagogue services for a year and a half? That he would have excluded himself from preaching to the Jews? We read in verses 7 and 8, we read that Crispus and Justus were both Roman names and both proselytes. They were believers in God. One of them was next to the synagogue. One was in the synagogue. It's a bit contradictory for us to say Paul never would go to the Jews again. We know that he did, and we're going to see this over and over and over again. So what did he mean? It may be a bit contradictory, but let's see what we can make of it. Ellicott in his commentary says, the words are almost identical to those in Acts 13, verse 46. We read that. He said, I'm done with the Jews. I'm not going there anymore. I'm going to go to the Greeks, the Gentiles, and are explained by them. It is obvious in each case that the words have a limited and local application. The apostle did not renounce all future work among the Jews, but gave a preaching to those in Corinth. He was there for a year and a half. I think we have a little bit of waffling here by the commentary. He's still engaged. He still talked to them. It's easier to see Paul's words as hasty. Remember, Paul is not divine. He is not holy Paul. He is a human being, and he was angry. He was tired of getting rejected, but he knew it would happen again. But the remainder of Acts shows how Paul and others' motives, their love, and we heard it in the, I think the first message, we did hear it in the opening prayer. We see his motives and his love and his passion for the people that he preached to. His passion. It says there was, in verse 9, that the Lord spoke to him. How many of you have it in red letter in your Bible? Most of you? Some of you? How many of you don't have a Bible? Yeah, most of you have it as red letter. When it's in red letter, it means it's the words of Jesus. And so this is why when the Lord here is used in the book of Acts many times, the word Lord means Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ speaks to him, "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city." And therefore, verse 11, he continued there a year and a half, teaching the word of God among them. I believe this means he did it. He said what he did by mistake. He was angry. I'd be angry. You'd be angry. No one likes to be rejected. But he was given a promise. Verse 12, it starts to get a little crazy. We're going to read it with just a little bit of comment. When Gallio was proconsul, that's the Roman proconsul of Achaia, which is a large geographical area, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." Now, Gallio is the Roman proconsul. They take him to the, who takes him to the judgment seat? Well, Paul may have been done with the Jews for 15 minutes. The Jews are not done with Paul. They take him to the judgment seat. The word means is bima, and it means the Roman seat of government. And he says this, they say, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." Contrary to the law? What law? Would you take someone to a court in a wrong jurisdiction that they had no authority over? Therefore, this must be Roman law. And it's very similar to what we read in Acts chapter 17. When the Jews who were not persuaded became envious, this is of Stephen, they said, "He teaches against the decrees of Caesar." Very similar. In verse 14, when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear you. But if it is a question of words and names and of your own law, look to it to yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of these matters." And he drove them from the judgment seat. Then all the Greeks, this next verse makes a lot of sense. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. But Gallio took no notice of these things. What a strange series of events. The Jews take Paul. Paul tries to defend himself. Who defends him? Gallio, the Roman proconsul. He drives them, the Jews, away with Paul. We hear nothing of Paul, but for some odd reason, some strange reason, verse 17, the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him. We're not told why, for what reason. It's just a strange, very strange series of events. What's interesting about the Gallio, the Expositor's Bible Commentary, as many others do, said this was an issue of Roman law. Because remember the Romans, did they worship God and the gods? They sure did. They had their own set of theologies. And the accusers, the Jews, are about as vague as they could possibly be. In what way did Paul violate worship of God? Who were they appealing to? If Gallio had made a decision, what Roman law would he cite? Whatever law he would cite, he would set precedent. And because he was over a large geographical area, this precedent would apply to many, many thousands and thousands of people, to not only Roman law, but Judaism, because Judaism was a recognized religion of the time. Gallio is not impressed. He wants nothing to do with it. So in a logical matter, as we say, they beat Sosthenes. I have no idea. I looked at every commentary I could lay my hands on. No one had a clue what the reason was. It's just there. They dragged the ruler of the synagogue to the Roman seat and they beat him. No sense. But what of Paul? This was probably a direct fulfillment of the prophecy that the Lord, Jesus Christ, gave to him. "Don't be afraid. Speak freely. I will protect you. No one will hurt you." go right ahead and do what you have been doing. God protected him. So what are we to make of all this? We see that Paul and his companions had a clear and distinctive motive. They knew what they wanted to do. They knew who they wanted to speak to. Verse 18. So Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. Now note, he had his hair cut off at Centuria, for he had taken a vow, and he came to Ephesus and left them there. But he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned, there's that word again, reasoned again with the Jews of Ephesus. When they asked him to stay longer time with them, he did not consent. But he took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem. But I will return again to you, God willing. And he sailed from Ephesus. He took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you. How many of you do not have that in your Bible? Look carefully. If you have a New King James, it's there. If you're reading any other version except King James or New King James, it isn't there. It isn't there. Everybody has it in their Bible? That means you have a New King James in front of yours. If you do, yeah. Now people are starting to raise their hands. If there's any other translation, what is this all about? When we read these verses, Paul and the others have been subjected to, accused of, and what they've been beaten for, the truth. In verse 18, he says he will stay a while in Caesarea. He takes a vow, shaving his head. The commentaries are divided on whether this was a Nazarite vow. Nazarite vows were usually connected somehow, some way to Jerusalem. He was not in Jerusalem. It's Jerusalem-centered. It proves that Paul felt obligated to observe even concepts and cultural aspects of the law. The commentaries are near silent on this, of why he took this vow. I'm not surprised. I do not wonder why they are silent on this. I checked commentary after commentary. There was no comment on why did Paul still feel obligated to take a vow to shave his head, whether or not it was a Nazarite vow. Why? I found one commentary, the Jewish New Testament commentary, saying this. This may have been a diaspora adaptation. Diaspora is the Jews of Jerusalem. Then there's the diaspora, those that have been scattered to the four winds all over the world in that day in different parts of the immediate area. It could have been a diaspora adaptation. In other words, the outlying Jewish communities adapted a Nazarite vow. They had their own regional vows. But no matter what the details of Shaul or Paul's vow were, this verse proves that he did not abandon the Torah. On the contrary, even when he became a Gentile among Gentiles, he continued to observe Jewish practices. So what about this verse that's missing? Verse 21, by all means, I must observe this feast in Jerusalem. It is near identical with Acts chapter 20. We can turn there very quickly. Acts chapter 20. Well, I'll let you do it on your own. It's a good section to read. Acts chapter 20, verse 16. It's nearly identical. This verse is only in the King James Version, the New King James, some literal translations which are few and far between, but all modern translations except for the New King James and King James have dropped it. It is a question of Greek manuscripts. That is a thorny subject, and I am not qualified, and few others are, to speak on manuscripts. But I can research, as you can. Acts chapter 18, verse 21 has scores of discussion groups on why these verses are left out. It is in the early manuscript. It is not in the early manuscripts. It is in some, but it is found in later manuscripts. There is a theory of older is better, which is not always true. So that is the issue. The shorter version leaves out the feast, keeping the feast at Jerusalem, and the shorter version that does not have it, and the longer version that we have in our New King James. That is the longer version. One source by J.M. Ross in an article entitled The Extra Words of Acts 18:21 analyzes the longer version that we have in the New King James having to do with Paul kept the feast or wanted to keep the feast by all means in Jerusalem. He says this, quote, "The shorter version could have got into a wide variety of manuscripts and versions if the words had been omitted sufficiently early." Next, the fact that, hear this, the fact that 20th century scholars cannot think of a motive for deliberate omission does not prove that the words were not in the original text. But there is a possible motive. The words could have been excised, removed. The words could have been excised by someone who thought Christians ought not to attend Jewish festivals, and removed the words so as not to give a, this is sarcasm, so as not to give a Pauline example of such a reprehensible bit of conduct. That's the author's own words. In other words, they were excised by someone who did not feel that Paul should be seen as keeping the feast in Jerusalem, either connected to or not connected to his shaving of a head with a vow. What was the motive here? If the scribe's motive that removed it, it wasn't honorable. If it was true, it was not an honorable motive in any way, shape, or form. But he forgot Acts chapter 20. Turn there if you would with me. We'll pick it up in verse 6 of chapter 20. "But we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days joined them at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. Verse 16. "For Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost." This proves that he kept the feasts in their order. "I must by all means observe this feast in Jerusalem." This was his passion, to keep these feast days. His audience knew exactly what and why he says this, what motivates him to do these things. And can we glean that it was the desire by Paul and the disciples that we read about chapter after chapter after chapter in the book of Acts? It was their desire to obey God, to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to observe the holy days. "I must, by all means, no matter what, I must observe this feast in Jerusalem." Can we take anything from these verses for here and for now and apply them? We cannot enter other religious venues, services. As we said, it is wrong, it is foolish, it is unproductive. And we in our church would not want it done to us. We don't feel, from a church cultural aspect, we do not wish to go door to door. And I get that. You gotta have guts to do that. But can we not, especially as we are upcoming on Passover and the Passover season, which again is the season where the highest concentration of the holy days is in the spring holidays, this Passover season that will be upon us, take a small page from this book of Acts and utilize it somehow, some way. In our own paths, our own individual paths, as different and as diverse as we may be, we have this commonality. We have this commonality of belief. Our passions, can we not renew them as we approach the spring holidays? If not now, and later, then when? Can we not renew it and possibly increase it? Because in many, many ways, we are very much like Paul and the disciples. To Paul, Silas, Timothy, Aquila, and Priscilla. We're very much like them in many ways. We just live in a different geography. We do speak a different language. But the culture is the culture of the world, and we live in a very similar culture. We believe in the same things they believed. When you see them observe the synagogue Sabbath service, when you see them observe the holy days, when they rush to be at a certain holy day convocation, we feel the same thing, don't we? We identify with these words. That's why we read them. They're not strange to us or foreign to us. We understand them. Again, we identify them. And again, I just think it's interesting. We do live in a type of Corinth, don't we? It's crazy here. I don't know about New York. We lived in close proximity for a while, New York. The phrase back in New York is, if you can make it here, you can make it. Forget that. Forget about it. If you can make it in California, you can make it anywhere. The setting, as was we see in Acts chapter 18, is very, very similar. Can we not attempt to prayerfully and respectfully to be the people in this book that we read about? If indeed the book of Acts is the Acts of the Apostles, the Acts of the Believers, the Acts of those that are spreading the gospel, indeed, why do we read it? For historical content? For interesting phrasing? Or that we can identify with them and possibly replicate it? How? Well, as you heard in the first message, we do this humbly. So allow me to give you 10 to 12 ideas that I've condensed to three. Three is God's number of, I'm not sure what, but whatever. Three is good. As an overarching theme, we'll take from Mr. Swindoll again, and he has a study guide on this. It's called, quote, the strength of an exacting passion. That's in my notes. It was in the, I think it was in the first message, and I know it was in the prayer. The strength of an exacting passion. Be confident, number one. Be confident. Be passionate in your core beliefs, the essentials, the things that make us unique and that are so biblical and so understandable, that we know them as truth. Be confident in your core beliefs. Read and study, as Mr. Madison said, read and study, and as best as possible, apply them. That's the hard part. That's the hard part about what we believe. Read and study them as best possible. Live them. Be known by them. Paul was. The apostles were. The disciples were. Two, be aware of opportunities. I think opportunities sometimes pass us in the night and we don't even recognize them, where we can indeed humbly speak to those beliefs. Why do you do the things you do, if you're ever asked? Or is there an opportunity to help someone with the truths that we know? Not preaching, helping. Listening, then helping. Humbly speak to those beliefs. Number three, observe and practice. We are a church of practice. They are biblical practices. We try not to do anything of observation or practice that we cannot find explicitly stated in the Old or New Testament. Observe and practice, especially the Sabbath and the holy days, those kept by Jesus and his followers. Often we're asked why we keep the days we do. It's simple. We make it so complex. Why do we keep the Sabbath and holy days? Because God commanded us? Absolutely. But Jesus kept these days. That's the rejoinder. It's not so much an Old Testament observation. It's a New Testament observation. The Apostle Paul and the disciples, those that preached the gospel, they kept these days that we read over and over. We will read even further as we complete the book of Acts. It was part of their core beliefs. The Sabbath and the holy days are the days that Jesus kept. Game, set, match. Game, set, match. We do it because God tells us to, and that Jesus, I think almost in some ways, almost more importantly, it's because Jesus kept these days. Jesus observed them. He believed in them, and he is in them. And so as we enter the season of the Passover holidays, I keep it short and simple. By all means, keep this feast.